And good morning. Welcome to another edition of Quest Youth Radio, better known as Quest Community Vibration. It is a happy day, and I want to send blessings out to everyone who is going through their own personal trials and tribulations. And the message is simple. You know, we will get by. There will be better days. Without any further ado, our introduction. Lyrics, like poetry, has a message. And history, like a diamond, shines clear to the truth. Words have meanings that we can all comprehend, like definition. You see, news creates a chain of events that we may not always understand. Now, I want you to pull back the curtain and see the real contributions, and you will find our Quest moment, where we attempt to make waves so that you can develop a critical thought and think for yourself. Join us, and thank you for joining us here today as we present another perspective of our diaspora. Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce our student host to take it away. Good morning, Walter.
Good morning. Good morning, everybody. Again, welcome to another edition of Quest Community Vibrations. We're live on 89.5, you know, and I guess I could start with my first segment of the day, which is diamonds. And see, history is like a diamond. Each prism represents the work of a group of people at a particular period of time. Look into the diamond and see the reflections of your past self, the pain of your mother, the choice of your father, and the blood of your ancestors. And look deeply, and you are bound to find yourself. Now, see, again, earlier this week, me and Mr. Bay were talking, and we were talking about our two diamonds that we were doing this Saturday, and our first diamond for today will be James Weldon Johnson. A Way With Words. These were beautiful words that would be sung long after James Weldon Johnson was dead. In 1900, James wrote this verse to music composed by his brother John. Their song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, became known as the Negro National Anthem. Generations of black people have sung this song with pride. James was an educator, poet, novelist, diplomat, and civil rights leader. He cared deeply about his people and worked to improve their lives. In 1920, he became the executive secretary of the NAACP. Black culture was important to James. He wrote many important books about black people's contributions to music, religion, and theater. He also wrote a novel called The Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man. James also served as a diplomat and consul for the United States and Venezuela. And, yeah, that concludes my piece on James Weldon Johnson, but that doesn't conclude the talk about him, because he made a very important song to the African-American community and people that was very much needed, Lift Every Voice and Sing. You know, the audience, you know, I believe everybody in the audience probably knows about this song, and probably grew up listening to it, hearing it at our ceremonies, you know, at school. Most likely you heard it before. And this song is very prominent because it uplifts and it motivates and it brings together unity with the black community. And that was something that was definitely needed during the 1900s, where he wrote the song, you know, and that's exactly what I get when I listen to the song. I hear unity for us. I hear us staying together, not fighting. And that's what we needed, you know. And I just believe that this song is not presented enough and not known enough to some people. Because I remember an example where You know, it was people coming into my school for a ceremony. We were having, I believe, a ceremony. And one of the white audience members, he heard it and he asked one of the kids, oh, this is your school song? You're saying something like that. You know, it's, I believe it's not just him. It's other people that think the same way, that don't understand and never really heard of the song. And I believe it just should be presented more because, you know, you have the American National Anthem, but, you know, this country was built on the backs of African Americans. So I believe we should be able to present our song just as much so people could get the understanding of what we're really about and what we really need, which is unity. So, yeah, you know, he was also, James Weldon Johnson was also somebody who was prominent in the Harlem Renaissance, another key moment in the African-American movement that revived our literature, our art and culture and all that, and literature as well. He was a part of that as well. He wrote a couple poems and books during that time. And in conclusion, you know, James Weldon Johnson is a person who many people just start to understand and know his, he was, I guess you could say, a pioneer, and he was someone who pushed for African Americans during two key parts of our history. The Harlem Renaissance and also writing Lift Every Voice and Sing. So he was, of course, the person at the top for progression for African Americans in America. So thank you.
Okay, good job. I want to introduce former mayor of Irvington, New Jersey. Mr. Wayne Smith is on the line and joining us. And Wayne, I'd like to present a question to you. As our topic lean around the subject of voting and history of African Americans, Walter presents a very interesting question. He feels that the broader audience or people in our society don't even know the song or the relevance of Lift Every Voice and Sing. Can you speak to that?
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, history in itself is an often forgotten lesson. People are so caught up in their day-to-day struggles. If they're not in school where they're studying it as a formal course of study, there's just not a lot of thought that goes into history and the meaning behind the things that we do. So Lift Every Voice and Sing obviously has played a significant role in the struggle of African Americans to make this country, as they say, a more perfect union. And in the lyrics itself, lift every voice, not property owners' voice, not just white people's voices, not just men's voices, but lift every voice. And so in that song itself, it is challenging America to live out the meaning of its creed that all men, and men we mean generically, male and female, have a voice in this society. And so the struggle for African Americans and even some others is to include all voices in the process. And we're still, as we go to the polls Tuesday, or some have already voted, some have voted by mail, some are voting today around the country. That is one way that we can get lift every voice. And so voting is one of those. And it was a struggle to get the right to vote. I mean, if people don't remember in the society, everybody could not vote. Many people take that right for granted, and some just don't because they don't know the struggle behind it. And so, you know, those cultural things like that song, Lift Every Voice and Sing, which is now entitled the national, what was called the National Negro Anthem, are powerful messages. And if you listen to, as I said, you listen to the lyrics, where, you know, that song challenged America to lift every voice and sing.
Okay. I'm going to use that as a transition. Thank you. Welcome. Don't you go anywhere. Stay on the line. And now it's time for we're going to transition to our next segment, which is going to be chains of events. And we have one of our panelists who's with us every week as an elder and someone who, you know, leads us in the right direction and always drops positive drinks upon us. Chains of events is an interpretation of news as it affects the minority community. Now, a lot of people don't like that word, minority, because they don't want to be called that. But it's from the Alloys of North. It's a report on business, religion, politics, law, and science. Chains of events reveals the interpretation of one event to another so that everyone out there that is listening will know what's happening. Good morning, Mr. Harris. How are you?
Good morning. Doing fine. And today our chain of events will deal with politics as it relates to our community. In order to reveal the connections between what was happening then and what's happening now, we're in another election cycle, and sadly, we seem to be asking ourselves the same questions. When is it going to be our turn? We've been asking these questions for a long time. And here is one rendition of our asking. It's called The Ballot or the Bullet by Elhaj Malik Shabazz, also known as Malcolm X. Before we try to explain what is meant by the ballot and the bullet, I would like to clarify something concerning myself. I'm still a Muslim. My religion is still Islam. That's my personal belief. Just as Adam Clayton Powell is a Christian minister who heads Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York, but at the same time takes a part in political struggles to try and bring about the rights to black people in this country. And Dr. Martin Luther King is a Christian minister down in Atlanta, Georgia, who has another organization fighting for civil rights and for black people in this country. And Reverend Gala Mason, I guess you've heard of him, is another Christian minister in New York who's been deeply involved in school boycotts to eliminate segregated education. Well, I myself am a minister, but not a Christian minister, but a Muslim minister, and I believe in action on all fronts by whatever means necessary. Although I'm a Muslim, I'm not here tonight to discuss my religion. I'm not here to try and change your religion. I'm not here to argue and discuss anything that we differ about, because it's time for us to submerge our differences and realize that it's best for us first to see what we have in common. And what we have is a common problem, a problem that will make you catch it, whether you're a Baptist, a Methodist, or a Muslim, or a nationalist. Whether you're educated or illiterate, whether you live on the boulevard or in the alley, you're going to catch it just like I am. We're all in the same boat, and we're all going to catch the same stuff from the same man. This man happens to be a white man. All of us have suffered here. In this country, political oppression at the hands of the white man, economic exploitation at the hands of the white man, and social degradation at the hands of the white man. Now, in speaking like this, it doesn't mean that we're anti-white, but it does mean that we're anti-exploitation, we're anti-degradation, we're anti-oppression. And if the white man doesn't want us to be anti him, let him stop oppressing and exploiting and degrading us. Whether we're Christian or Muslim, or nationalist, or agnostic, or atheist, we must first learn to forget our differences. If we have differences, let's defer in the closet. When we come out in front, let us not have anything to argue about until we finish arguing with the man. If the late John F. Kennedy could get together with Khrushchev and exchange some wheat, we certainly have more in common than each other one of they had, you know, so we should be able to do the same thing. If we don't do something real soon, I think you'll have to agree, we're going to be forced to either use the ballot or the bullet. It's one or the other in 1964. It isn't time is running out. Time has run out. I'm not a politician, not even a student of politics. In fact, I'm not a student of much of anything. I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. and I don't even consider myself an American. If you and I were American, there'd be no problem. Those immigrants just off the boat, they're already Americans. Polacks are already Americans. The Italian refugees are already Americans. Everybody that came from Europe, every blue-eyed thing, is already an American. And as long as you and I have been here, we're not Americans yet. Well, I'm one who doesn't believe in deluding myself. And I'm going to sit right here and watch you sit at your table, watch you eat with nothing on my plate, and call myself a diner. Sitting at the table doesn't make you a diner unless you have some of what's on the plate. Being here in America doesn't make you an American. Being born here in America doesn't make you an American. Why? If birth made you American, we wouldn't need any legislation. We wouldn't need any amendments to the Constitution. We wouldn't be faced with civil rights filibustering in Washington, D.C. right now. We wouldn't have to pass civil rights legislation to make Polacks an American. They didn't have to do that. No, I'm not an American. I'm one of 22 million black people who are victims of Americanism. One of the 22 million black people who are victims of democracy, nothing but disguised hypocrisy. So I'm not standing here speaking to you as an American or a patriot or a flag saluter or a flag waver. No, I'm not. I'm speaking to you as a victim of the American system. I see the American through the eyes of the victim. And I don't see any American dream. I see American nightmare. These 22 million victims are waking up. Their eyes are coming open. They're beginning to see what they used to only look at. They're becoming politically mature. They're realizing that there are new political trends from coast to coast. As they see these new political trends, it's possible for them to see that every time there's an election, the races are so close that they have to have a recount. They had a recount in Massachusetts to see who was going to be the governor. It was so close. They had the same thing in Rhode Island and Minnesota and in many other places in this country. The same with Nixon and Kennedy when they ran for president. It was so close that they had to do the count all over again. Well, what does this mean? It means that when white people are evenly divided, the black people have a block of votes of their own. It is left up to us to determine who's going to be sitting in the White House or who's going to be sitting in the doghouse. It was a black man's vote that put the present administration in Washington, D.C. Your vote, your dumb vote, your ignorant vote, your wasted vote put the administration in Washington, D.C. that has seen fit to pass every kind of legislation imaginable, saving you until last, and then filibustering on top of that. And your and my leaders have the audacity to run around clapping their hands, talking about how much progress we're making and what a good president we have. If he wasn't a good in Texas, he sure won't be good in Washington, D.C., because Texas is a lynch state. It's the same breath as Mississippi, no different. They lynch, only they lynch you in Texas with a Texas accent and lynch you in Mississippi with a Mississippi accent. These Negro leaders have the audacity to go and have some coffee in the White House with a Southerner, you know, and that's all he is, then come out and tell you and me that it's going to be better because since he's from the South, he knows how to deal with Southerners. What kind of logic is that? Let Eastland be president. He's from the South, too. He should be better able to deal with the Southerners than Johnson. So it's time in 1964 to wake up. And when you see them coming with that kind of conspiracy, let them know that your eyes are open. Let them know that there's something else that's going to be wide open, too. It's got to be the bullet or the ballot. The bullet or the ballot. If you're afraid to use that expression like that, then you should get out of the country. You should get back in the cotton patch. You should go back in the alley. They get all the Negro vote, and after they get it, the Negro gets nothing in return. All they did was go to Washington, give a few big Negroes big jobs. Those big Negroes didn't need big jobs. They already had jobs. That's camouflage. That's trickery and treachery, window dressing. I'm not trying to knock the Democrats for the Republicans. We'll get to them in a minute. But this is true. You put the Democrats first and the Democrats put you last. All right, I'm going to stop right here because this is a long and powerful speech, and anything this powerful must be broken down into segments in order to be digested. We're just into another election cycle where everybody is saying this is the most important vote of your lifetime. But what's in it for us? We have forgotten the tactic of leaving our differences in the closet and coming out with a united front. This says and is the most instructive thing that we do as people. The Panthers said you only can fight oppression and racism with unity. Malcolm said it before them. Elijah said it before them. Marcus Garvey said it before them. Martin Delaney said it before him. And we still haven't taken heed to that yet. So this is my chain of events for today, because we're going through the same type of thing today where we cannot get our differences separated from the reality that without unity, there will be nothing.
Okay. You have a lot there that we can unpack, but I want to first say that this particular program does understand that there is no white or black. There's just one people, and that is the human race. And without getting any further into that particular topic, I want to bring on our person from the political realm. It's a lot to unpack there, Wayne. And I just want to see if you have a question or a comment as it pertains to the ballot or the bullet, that particular poem that just was excerpt delivered by Mr. Shelton Harris.
Right. So, yes, I'm very, very familiar with that speech. And I think all speeches should be taken into the context of the time in which they're given and the real reality of what that message is saying. So I think, you know, during that time, you know, Malcolm talked about us being intelligent about our political engagement. And he's right. The Democrats and Republicans are not the end-all or be-all of political strategy for the upliftment of particularly African-Americans in their struggle. But I think what he is trying to get us to do, if you're going to participate in it, be intelligent. If you notice when you go throughout the speech, he talks about, and it's in the American Constitution, we all have the right to bear arms, but he did not encourage people. He encouraged people to defend themselves if attacked, but he did not encourage people to get out there and willy-nilly just have guns for the purposes of having guns or weapons or et cetera. Defend yourself if attacked, but, you know, he didn't encourage people like that. If you follow Malcolm's career from the point where he formally became, and everybody should read the autobiography of Malcolm X, it's in his own words. When he joined the Nation of Islam, even with the rhetoric of the Nation of Islam, they never formally encouraged violence of any type, even with the rhetoric that was used at that time. So, and Malcolm later evolved into, and I don't know, in that speech, he talked about his politics was a black nationalist philosophy that we should control our own local community. So he didn't discourage people from voting. I think the reality is he wanted us to be intelligent about our voting and understand that the political system is not the end all be all. It's just one strategy that you use to advance your condition. And just to follow up on Rich's comment, you know, so America is supposed to be a pluralistic society. So we know there's been systematic racism. We know all that. And so we've got to fight that struggle every day. But we also, at the same time, from the poor legacy of slavery till the day, have a stake in this country. And so we should not advocate that stake. We should get what's ours. And so people look at that in many ways. Some people are pushing the reparations movement. And obviously, I'm not opposed to that. Whatever we get, even from the political system, because when a guy works in City Hall who has a maintenance job, he isn't the director of a department. And some people would not have gotten that maintenance job if there not had been some political struggle for them to have the right to work in City Hall and county government and state government and the federal government. So we do have a stake in this game. We all pay taxes, even though Donald Trump does not. So I think we have to make sure the context of the time. So when Malcolm was talking, we're talking about the real challenges of the 1960s, and I think he was putting that in a context. And so if you're under siege, if your kids are being bitten by dogs because they're trying to get educated and so forth and so on, he's saying you do have the right to defend yourself. Now, but there's a political strategy involved with that. And you should be aware that the political strategy doesn't immediately get you to the outcomes that you want to go. So it's a very complex thing to unpack. People often take Malcolm's context, like they take Dr. King's comments out of context and don't put into the dynamics that were going on at the time and how we apply that today.
Okay. We're going to bring in a female perspective to what has been spoken about James Weldon Johnson, the ballot or the bullet, the fact that we have to understand an excerpt in context to the time of the late 60s. Tanisha Gardner, do you have a comment or a question?
I have a comment. So if you say take it in the context of the time is still the same. So the same thing they went through in 1964, it's the same thing that we're going right now in 2020. Why are we talking about the issues of us getting reparations when the Japanese got reparations, the Jews got reparations? And I guess you got to remember how America came to be. America was stolen. It was slaughtered. So how can we expect an empire that came in to be able to be to have justice or to be able to be civilized or to be able to have a conscience? That's why Malcolm X would say the ballot or the bullet. So if it's okay for Trump to say to the Proud Boys, which is a supremacist group, stand back and stand by, because under the Constitution, we have a right to bear arms to protect ourselves against anything that endangers anyone's well-being. So America was never about the prosperity of the black race or even the Native Indians. How can you come in and just slaughter a nation because you feel as though you're superior? So in that context, we have to remember who we are, where we came from, the legacy that we had as kings and queens, and how we taught, you know, in Europe when the Moors came, they taught them how to be civilized. But through history, I guess in America, they don't teach the children that. They're always teaching them about slavery. So I think that's where the disconnect comes from. And so when it comes to the voting, it's like, okay, am I voting for the devil or the witch? I understand, yes, you still vote because you still have a say in the legalities of it or the laws of it. So that means we have to put pressure on them to make sure that they do the right thing. And then if it takes the ballot or the bullet, it will come to that. Because also when he talked about the revolution and his speech, you know, he said revolution is not pretty. And then he said even in Hollywood, they never painted revolution as something being peaceful. But he also said that if the white man does not want to see that, you give us everything that was due to us. So at the end of the day, if they recognize what they've done to us and pay us back that way, then there's no need for a revolution. But a person's not going to sit back and allow you to keep killing their families, keep taking away from their families, and you telling me I can't eat, because all the laws that they passed is still happening today with the foreclosures. Why did you give homeowners bad mortgages? Because you knew they was going to fail. And why do we have failing school systems when, you know, especially in the city of Newark, you know, okay, you said the money's supposed to trickle down, but it's still disparities. And we've been fighting for this since my grandparents and great-grandparents. It has to be a change. People have to wake up. And that means that we have to take the power into hand by educating each other like we did before, like we had Black Wall Street. Even with Black Wall Street in Tulsa, Oklahoma, they bombed them. Like, that is crazy. You can't keep doing the same thing over and over and over again and you expect the same result that we're going to sit back and let you kill us and massacre us. It doesn't work that way. So I pray to God that they learn a lesson and they start to be humble and realize that, like you say, as a nation of people, that we have to work together globally, because there's oppression throughout the whole world. And we need to see that we have to work together. But like I always say, you have to remember the universal law is always polarity. You have negative and positive energy. So it's always going to be, I guess, that imbalance. But we have to put the balance in to make sure that the negative energy always stays in check. And the only reason why bad people flourish is because good people do nothing. So good people, we have to keep fighting. We have to keep striving. We have to keep on a path to make sure everything is still at an equilibrium.
Okay. That is our female perspective on what we're talking about, our topics for today. But I need to go to the youth. Walter, you've heard what's been on the floor, what we're talking about, and you being a teenager and listening to the history, what is your interpretation of today's discussion, and where do you see the future going for our people?
You know, we can only go up from here. Always being taught your history and understanding it, that's the biggest part of it. Like, you could learn about it, but you have to really understand it. That's how we move up and progress, and we become unified, and we understand that fighting each other does not help, and it's really negatively affecting us. So when I hear these discussions about everybody talking about the history and talking about how we've progressed, if people know that, it's going to motivate them to want to come together and continue to progress. So I only can see up from here. You know, it's going to be hard because it's still people, the world and the country is still divided. It's very divided. So just I believe the best thing for us is just to get as many people to understand that's willing to listen as possible, to unify and to continue to move on, because that is the best way and the best thing I see for the future.
I'm listening. Are you finished?
Oh, yeah. You know, and
well,
basically
yeah,
what I want to say
like...
is...
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Basically what I'm going to say is, yeah, the country is very divided right now, and there's people on both sides that disagree a lot, and there's a lot of debating. But if we get as many people as possible to move on with us, that's how progression and change is going to happen.
Okay. Now, I do know that Mr. Harris has more about Malcolm X. Mr. Harris, please continue. What do you have on tap there? What else you got?
All right. Well, just because of the flavor of the day, I'm just going to give a little thumbnail background of El-Hajj Malik Shabazz. You know, for the folks who really need a refresher or have never heard it before, you know, he was born Malcolm Little in May of 1925 in Omaha, Nebraska. His mother was a homemaker, and his father was an outspoken Baptist minister and an avid supporter of the Black nationalist leader Marcus Garvey. And his civil rights activism prompted death threats from a white supremacist organization called the Black Legion, forcing his family to relocate twice before Malcolm was 4 years old. Eventually, Malcolm and his buddy, Malcolm Shorty Jarvis, moved to Boston. In 1946, they was arrested and convicted on burglary charges, and Malcolm was sentenced to 10 years in prison. He was paroled after 7, though. Recalling his days in school, he used that time to further his education. And it was during that time of self-enlightenment that Malcolm's brother, Reginald, who visited and discussed his recent conversion to the Muslim religion. Reginald belonged to the religious organization called the Nation of Islam. Malcolm, being intelligent and articulate, he was appointed as minister and national spokesman for the Nation of Islam. Elijah Muhammad also charged him with establishing new mosques in cities like Detroit, Michigan, and Harlem, New York. Malcolm utilized newspaper columns as well as radio and television to communicate the Nation of Islam's message across the country. His charisma and drive and conviction attracted the most number of new members. Malcolm was largely credited with increasing the membership of the Nation of Islam from 5,500 in 1952 to 30,000 in 1963. Malcolm's faith was a crushing blow at his height of the civil rights movement in 1963. He learned that his mentor and leader, Elijah Muhammad, was secretly having relations with as many as six women in the Nation of Islam organization. And as that wasn't enough, Malcolm found out that some of these relationships had resulted in children. Shortly after this shocking discovery, Malcolm receives criticism from a comment he made after the assassination of John F. Kennedy, where he said Kennedy never foresaw that the chickens would come to roost so soon. After that statement, Elijah Muhammad silenced Malcolm for 90 days. You know, but Malcolm kind of suspected that his silence was for another reason. And in March of 1964, he terminated his relationship with the Nation of Islam. Unable to look past his Muhammad's deceptions, Malcolm decided to find his own religious organization called the Muslim Mosque Incorporated. After he resigned his position in the Nation of Islam and renounced Elijah Muhammad's, relationships between the two became increasingly volatile. FBI informants working undercover in the Nation of Islam warned officials that Malcolm had been marked for assassination. The one undercover officer had even been ordered to plant a bomb in Malcolm's car. 1 week later, however, Malcolm's enemies were successful in their ruthless attempt. In speaking at the Manhattan's Audubon Audit Ballroom in February 21st, 1965, three gunmen rushed on stage. They shot him 15 times at close range, and the 39-year-old was pronounced dead on arrival at New York's Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. And, you know, and what happened after his assassination, the doors of the Audubon Ballroom were closed due to lack of payment of taxes. The city assumed ownership of the building in 1967, and for years, the fate of the Audubon Ballroom was uncertain. In the early 1990s, the entire site on Broadway between 165th Street and 166th Street, including the ballroom, faced demolition. A grassroots organization, along with Dr. Betty Shabazz, successfully advocated to preserve the Audubon Ballroom as a memorial to Malcolm X and a permanent symbol of the African-American struggle for equality. After the debate, an agreement was reached to restore the section of the Audubon Ballroom as a designated memorial to Malcolm X. Betty Shabazz was integral in planning for what was to come the Malcolm X Memorial Center, with the intention to retire with a focus on further preserving the integrity of her husband's legacy through the center. After her faithful or unsavable demise in 1997, however, with dedicated individuals spearheaded by Ilyaza Shabazz and Julio Peterson, the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center officially opened its doors to the public in 2005. In collaboration with the Shabazz family and Columbia University community support. One of the things, you know, because usually when they have stuff like this, their mission statement was the Malcolm X and Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center, or better known as the Shabazz Center, harnesses the legacies and continues the work of Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz through a worldwide advancement of human rights, social justice, high-impact programming in New York City. At the site of Malcolm's martyrdom, the Shabazz Center is an internationally recognized historical site. The Shabazz Center honors the memory and inspiration of Malcolm X and Betty with events and programs that promote a public discourse and exchange on issues of relevant to both the African diaspora and the community at large, as well as educational, cultural, and social activities that catalyze change throughout the nation. And I haven't been to the Shabazz Center personally, but, you know, whenever all of this madness is over, that should be a place for a lot of people who try to go and see the kind of mindset that he had. He was talking about the same things that folks are talking about today, but he was doing it almost 60 years ago. And, you know, and he was very articulate about the way he expressed himself. And a lot of people from the whole, not just the African diaspora, but from the whole society would learn a lot from finding out what this brother was about and his wonderful wife. That was the curtain that we pulled off today, just to stay in the same mindset of what we were talking about already today.
Okay. I want to add that in the city of Newark right now, we have our mayor, Honorable Mayor Ross Baraka, who has started a book club. And if you live in the city of Newark, you can go to any public library and pick up the autobiography of Malcolm X for free of charge, okay, and join the mayor's book club. I think it's timely. I think for such an iconic figure from our historical past and perspective, you do need to take your family, your children, and during this pandemic, educate yourselves to have a critical thought and think. I can't say that enough. As we continue, I'm going to go right back to Mayor Wayne Smith, former mayor of Irvington. You've listened to the show. One of my introductional statements is, you know, we attempt to make waves. And so I know the show has been insightful, but have we made waves here today?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I think that the importance of giving various perspectives on how we engage struggle and using both Lift Every Voice and Sing and the history of El-Hajj Malik Shabazz, many know as Malcolm X, is a critical point. I did want to comment on a couple things real quick from the last commentary. And I'm glad that Mayor Baraka is giving the book out in the city of Newark. If you don't live in Newark, go buy the book. Get your parents, buy the book for your children. It's an excellent read. And an interesting thing about the history is the FBI's role in creating the division between the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm and fomenting dissent to destroy their relationship. Malcolm said later in the book that he stopped saying that the Nation of Islam was out to kill him because he saw things that the Nation of Islam could not do. When he began to travel abroad, he saw things happen to him that was beyond the scope of what the Nation of Islam had the capacity to do. And so he says this himself in the book. So there was a lot of machinations going on in creating the division between Elijah Muhammad and Malcolm and Malcolm's assassination. The other seed I want to drop here is invest in your children early, philosophically, religiously, whatever your point of view is, because Malcolm came back to his father's roots in the Garvey movement, the similarities of self-determination and black economics that came out of the Garvey movement was also a philosophy of the Nation of Islam, and Malcolm promoted that philosophy. But the roots were established by his father. He was able to come back to that. And so what we put into our young people today will often bear fruits many times later. I also want to comment on Dr. Shabazz, who was a nurse. People don't know that Betty Shabazz was a nurse and paid a tremendous sacrifice being the wife of Malcolm. And went on back to school to become Dr. Shabazz, and was a dean, I think, at Meggers Evers College. So she also, even after the death of Malcolm, continued struggle. She raised her children, and all of them became contributors of society. I just wanted to add that commentary. But yeah, you made some waves, bro.
Okay. All right. And I don't laugh facetiously, but there's a job that has to be done. And Quest Youth Radio, Quest Community Vibrations, live on 89.5, is trying to step up to the plate and meet the challenge. And once again, as I said at the beginning, I send a blessing out to everyone who is struggling through this pandemic. We are aware. And before we end, we're going to talk about the importance of voting and why people should get out and practice their civic duty. But right now we continue with our format, and we bring back our student host who has another segment to change and transition, Mr. Walter Pierce.
Yep. All right. So getting back to the diamond that I have planned, we're staying musical, and we're going to be talking about a classical giant by the name of Ulysses Kay. Some people believe that classical music was too difficult for black people to master. Men like William Grant Still, Dean Dixon, and Ulysses Kay proved them wrong. These talented black men became outstanding composers and conductors. Ulysses Kay decided to make music his career when he was young. He had always loved music, but he had to study hard if he wanted to succeed. He attended the Eastman School of Music, the Berkshire Music Center, and Yale University. He learned to compose. After serving in the United States Navy during World War II, Ulysses quickly became the most important black composer of the classical music in the United States. He received numerous awards, including the Gershwin Memorial Prize, a Broadcast Music Incorporation Award, and an American Broadcasting Company Prize. Short Overture and The Juggler of Our Lady are a couple of his most popular works. Ulysses will be remembered not only as a great composer, but also as a black pioneer in classical music. And to talk a little deeper into Ulysses Kay, the reason I chose him is, of course, I wanted to do him and James Walter Johnson together because of the musical part and how prominent they were to both of their fields, either James Weldon Johnson having his song, which was for the African-American community during that time to uplift, motivate, and unify. And you have Ulysses Kay here, who was a pioneer for black classical artists who wanted to be in the field. They have somebody they could look up to, an example, who was very, very talented. And also, you know, I played the trumpet back a couple years back, and most of the people, or really I should say all of the music I played dealing with classical music was made by somebody of European descent. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but the thing is I really didn't hear anything about other types of classical artists from other continents and other countries, other backgrounds. And, you know, me hearing about Ulysses Kay and him writing classical music, it would have been nice to play and to play some of his music and probably listen to it. And, you know, lastly, I just want to point out, like, I know a lot of people probably don't really listen and like classical music, but me, it's not my favorite, but it's something I could definitely enjoy because some of the songs are just so powerful and could be used to depict a plot because there's a climax in the song, either a very high point where you know it's a lot of drama, or it's a sad part, or it's a very happy part of the song. Like classical music, it could paint that picture with all these different types of instruments blending together to make beautiful music. So, you know, just somebody like him, I just wish I would have known a little bit earlier and understood his music, and he would have been somebody that would have been an inspiration for me. And I know he's an inspiration for a lot of other people who play classical music, who either conducted or play an instrument. And thank you.
Well, very good job once again. And I need to say that music is universal, and so is classical music. And so we won't presume that We know that black people are not monolithic, and we do listen to classical music as well. I just need to say that, right? Tanisha Gardner, question or comment?
A comment. I definitely want to say thank you, Walter, for that, because we don't know. I guess through the history, I guess definitely in school, I wasn't too familiar with any African American, I guess, composers. I know in school they always taught you about like Mozart, Beethoven, Haydn, Franz Schubert. But it's so funny because right now I'm doing some research now, and you see from, you know, 1685 all the way up to the 1800s of, you know, the European. But then when you look at, you know, the African-Americans, it's the same time frame, or maybe a year after, of, you know, from 1745 through the same period of the 1800s. Like, for instance, Joseph Boulogne Chauvet, De St. George, which was in 1745, and he was dubbed as the Black Mozart, or like Florence Prince was the first African-American woman to also do it, and Scott Joplin. So I'm happy that Walter brought that up, because that made me do my own research and want to delve in more of how we have such an impact on music. And, you know, especially to be able to educate the children on it, to let them know of how, you know, how hip hop came to be, how R&B came to be. And with all those elements, that's what created the music now. So it's very powerful, and it makes you think about, you know, the African drums of, you know, of our ceremonies, and how that is still relevant to this day, even though you might not hear, you know, the African drums be playing in classical music, but just to have that way of thinking to be able to compose that type of vibration for people to understand, or to mellow out, or, you know, to be able to concentrate, you know, because a lot of people use, you know, classical music to, you know, to write, to meditate, to do different things, and it's very powerful. So I just want to thank Walter for that.
Okay, good job. Now I want to bring back Mr. Shelton Harris, because I know he is a music enthusiast. So I'm wondering what thoughts go through your mind, Mr. Harris, when you hear Walter talk about a black composer of classical music.
Yeah, well, see, there's a lot of things about what we call classical and how we kind of rate stuff, but there have been people of African descent making classical music for hundreds of years. Like people try to big up Beethoven. Like, you know, he was part Moor. You know, if you ever seen any pictures of him, he was like the dark skin, he had like the crazy hair, you know. And usually when we talk of classical, we're only talking about European music, you know, but classical means anything that holds an exemplary standard, anything that's really like high brow. And there have always been people of color that have exemplified the highest in music, like, you know, like American classical music. Anything that you can say is American classical music really has to do with African-American music. You know, like, I always thought that Duke Ellington played classical music because he held his music to an exemplary high standard. The same thing with a lot of what we call jazz artists, you know. And the classical, as far as the European, most of their instruments are African instruments that they were using to make these sounds. And, you know, they really just bit off of what they learned from us, took it to another place, and then created like a mindset that they started this all together. And, you know, and we really need to, you know, again, we need to understand what our definitions of our words are so that we can follow through and see that there's some of everybody in everything. And that's the most important part. But it was good to hear about that, because I've never heard of that particular brother, you know, or the other people he was talking about. This was news to me. But the fact that we do things on an exemplary high level, that part is not news to me because we've always done that.
Okay. Well, some of the tag words that I use to describe today's show is critical thinking, which is two words, unity, renaissance, election, voting, civil rights, more importantly, civic. That being said, what is, and I'm going to start with Mayor Wayne Smith, what is the importance of getting out and practicing your civic duty and actually voting, casting your vote?
Well, you know, lift every voice and sing. That is your one way that you can lift your voice, candidate of your choice, issue of your choice. I think the last show that I was on with you, Richard, we talked about the ballot questions. There's several
right.
ballot questions that impact us and how government is structured. Some social justice, some people view the marijuana issue as a social justice issue. They're going to be voting on the legalization of that. So whether you're pro for it or against it, somebody's going to decide that. And only the people who are going to have an impact on what happens is the people that vote. So, you know, that's the importance of exercising your civic duty.
Okay. We're going to go, Mr. Harris, what is the importance of practicing your civic duty, getting out there and voting?
Yeah, well, personally, I think voting is very important for its place in our struggle. You know, we have to stop looking at it as it's going to be an end all to all of our problems just in case we vote. It's a chess move. It's something that we need to use as a tactic and a strategy that, which combined with other things, that's going to help help the whole country become a better place. And, you know, that to me, that's our civic duty, is to make it a better place.
Okay. Mr. Tanisha Gardner, same question.
It's our civic duty. We have to hold them accountable. And the way that we hold them accountable is even after the election. Because reality, everybody's not going to vote. And if they don't vote, it's okay. The ones that are going to vote, make a difference. And then, like I said, at the end of the day, it's up to us to make the change. So if the ones that don't vote, like for instance, you have different levels to government. You have your state, you have your local, and you have your federal, and you have your county. So on any of them, if you have to go out and speak to your council meetings, you speak to any of the board meetings, you go to your planning board meetings, you go to your zoning board meetings, have some type of participation in a civic duty. So if that means that you have to organize, if you feel as though the laws are not justified for you, be able to speak at the Senate meetings. There's so many different aspects that you can do to, you know, to help your fellow man.
Okay. Walter, you've heard today's show, and we have less than 2 minutes of our program left. I need you, from your perspective, to sum up this show. And I know that's a challenging question, but I'm sure you can handle it because you've been doing this long enough. Talk to us.
All right. So, you know, this show was full of different segments and different perspectives on the narrative of our Black history. You know, I started off with James Weldon Johnson and talking about how his song brought unity and togetherness, and it brought something to the African-American community that was very much needed during that time period. And Mr. Harris, Shelton Harris, bringing in his two segments, you know, talking about the perspective of Malcolm X, and also one of my favorite parts of it, of how even if you're born in America, you're not American. And thinking about that, especially during the time period he said that is something that is very true. You know, people who were born here from other countries were still getting deported and sent back to their countries, which is something that is crazy to think about. You know, and then we have the discussion about Ulysses K and how classical music is for all and from all backgrounds, and it's something that can paint a picture and tell a story. And how the pioneer, Ulysses K, how people want to go into the field of classical music can look up to him, and you know, and progress. And you know, we ended off the show just talking about that, and I just enjoyed all the different points of view from everybody. And I want to thank Mr. Wayne Smith for coming in, giving an amazing perspective on his part of his idea of what everybody was saying. And again, thank you for everybody participating in it.
Good job, Walter. Wayne Smith, 5 seconds, last words.
Lift every voice and sing, brother.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Tanisha Gardner. Thank you, Shelton Harris. Student host, Walter Pierce. And yes, we have been insightful and made waves. We have had another Quest moment where we not only attempted, but we did make waves. Thank you again for joining us. And I trust that you had a critical thought and you were able to hear a different perspective from our diaspora. You're tuned to Quest Community Vibrations, better known as Quest Youth Radio, which is the best youth radio on 89.5 FM. Thank you again, and peace.